Great, let us begin. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. After spending a full day working already, now you're going to have to work some more. So it goes. My name is Michael Pellett, and I'm the pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And I'm also a professor in the philosophy department at the University of Saskatchewan. So it keeps me busy. And I'm here this week to start off the theme, Beginning Together. So we're going to be looking at different understandings of beginnings, and beginnings as it's seen in terms of the gospel, in terms of the Christian community, in terms of our calling, how there are beginnings within beginnings. And so that's why the overall theme is, let us begin to commence to start, because that's how it works. And today, we're going to look at probably two obvious texts that talk about beginnings, Genesis chapter 1 and John chapter 1, and a text that may not quite seem like beginnings, but John chapter 2, the wedding feast at Cana, and how that too is a sense of beginnings. And so we'll look at that. So first of all, we'll look at Genesis chapter 1, which is, I'm sure, a pretty familiar story to most of you. And before there, before we do that, I'm going to have to put on my philosophy hat for a moment and say that the whole notion of beginning is a great philosophical conundrum, because when you think of beginning, it becomes a temporal category, and you can never pin down that sense of beginning, because especially if you think about it in a linear way, you say, well, when did it begin? Well, it began right here at time t1. But you say, but I can think of a time right before that. So that would be the beginning. And then you'll come back to me and say, but I can think of a time before that. And then John will think of a time before. And there we go. And so, right, we're in an actual infinite loop and cannot determine any sense of beginning. And so, of course, philosophers who want to be rational are driven crazy by this. And so they're going to say, okay, so when we think of beginning, we can think of beginning in three different ways. The first way we think of beginning is a logical sense of beginning. That's in terms of cause and effect. A cause is the beginning, one can say, of a certain effect. But of course, the challenge there is always to make sure you can find the right cause for the effect so that you have the right beginning for what follows. But that's a logical sense of beginning. The second way to talk about beginning is a temporal way, a timely way of talking about beginning, but it's temporal in terms of the notion of origin. When did something originate? Or where is its source? And so there you can talk about things even like the origin or the source of a river. Or here Genesis wants to talk about, in one respect, the origin of creation and how we are to understand it. The third way to understand beginning, and this is our fancy word of the day when you can talk to everyone else in the dining hall and impress them to say, well, you know what, I've been hermeneutical for the last hour. And that is a hermeneutical sense of beginning. Hermeneutical is the Greek word, comes from its root, from the Greek god Hermes. In Roman pantheons, this is Mercury, and Hermes is the messenger god. When Zeus wants to take a message to somebody else, he calls Hermes over and says, "Hey, go tell so-and-so I'm going to kill him." Right. So Hermes does that. So Hermes is the messenger god, the god of communication. And so the whole understanding of hermeneutics is the understanding of interpretation. And so when does something begin is understood as the moment of recognition. When one recognizes something as different from what had preceded, that you are pursuing a question, for example, in a new and different way, with that recognition becomes about this sense of beginning, because it is a sense of change. And again, philosophically speaking, the classic example from that is Aristotle. And his example is, when did an army begin to retreat? And you know, you think about that and say, well, was an army in retreat when the first soldier said, whoop, and turned around and started to run? Well, no, that may not have been retreat. That might just be a coward who didn't want to get killed. So when did retreat happen? And he would say, well, retreat happens when the general or the military commander recognizes that their army is being outflanked or something by the other army, and with that moment of recognition goes, hey, retreat! And of course that change happens. That's the beginning of the retreat, the moment of recognition. And at least then, philosophically, and indeed I would want to argue theologically understood, it is this hermeneutical sense, this moment of recognition, that marks the sense of a beginning. And we'll see that a little later this week, tomorrow, I think, when we look at what was our gospel lesson for this Sunday, the whole understanding of the disciples on the way to Emmaus. Because, of course, that story is all about recognition. And what happens when they recognize Jesus, and what's that the beginning of? And so we'll work our way through that. So, three senses of beginning: logical, temporal, hermeneutical. Cause and effect, origin, recognition. And for the most part, our notions of beginning is going to deal with recognition. So that's kind of the preamble to all of this. So with that, now we can take a look at Genesis chapter 1 and start with that first phrase, in the beginning. Or it can also be translated, when God began to create. So we have in the beginning, which is what most Bibles have. Or, and this is actually what the rabbis prefer, when God began to create. Okay, now, why would the rabbis want to go with this reading rather than in the beginning? Although both are possible in terms of that. Well, the first comment we have on that is from Jewish rabbi in the early Middle Ages, Rashi. And what he did was simply compile the sayings of the rabbis that preceded him in terms of various comments on Scripture, and use that as kind of his commentary on the Torah. And Rashi says about this first verse and this first clause, he says, the text would have been written Bereshona, in other words, a little variation on the Hebrew verb here, if its primary purpose had been to teach the order in which creation took place. When understands creation as an ongoing work which God has begun and continues. And so that understanding here is, right, when God began to create, when you translate it in this way, it has a continuing force. In other words, the understanding here is God has never stopped creating. Creating is a continual, ongoing process. Now, within Christian interpretation, that notion of in the beginning became the preferred reading after the Christian theologian Augustine, and also later Muslim commentators and theologians liked it. And they liked in the beginning because their sense of that emphasized, again, Augustine's phrase, creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. And Augustine wanted creation out of nothing for what reason? Any guesses? Theologians in our group? Why creation out of nothing?
It shows that God is all powerful because no one has ever done that.
Yeah?
It means creation is not evil.
True. Yeah. It could be against those who kind of are dualists and say material is bad and spiritual is good. So if it's out of nothing, it couldn't be out of something bad. Anything else?
That there was nothing before creation.
Yeah, maybe.
Creation is, there is nothing without God.
True. Yeah. See, that would be looking at it from a logical perspective. For Augustine, it's a moment of recognition because he would claim, and again, he gets this from the Gospels, and particularly Paul, his claim is, if you want to look for the real creation story, the real creation story is not Genesis 1 or 2, but it's
Jesus and John.
John 1.
Not John 1. But you're at least in the right testament, huh?
Revelation,
Nope. We're in the season. Easter. Resurrection. Resurrection is the creation story because what? Out of death, God creates life, right? God raised Jesus from the dead. And that, Augustine says, is our real paradigm for creation. What creation is truly all about is how God can bring life out of death. And the resurrection stories, the resurrection accounts, the resurrection appearances are precisely the recognition of that. And that is the key, he would say, to what Christians, right, the first Christian community witnesses to that, and we continue that witness. And we live that witness. Right. That it is God who can bring life out of death. And so therefore, right, the Christian interpretation of that first clause was more in the beginning, because that was that stark sense of from nothing, all of life, all of creation comes forth. So that's one sense of how to think about beginnings. Secondly, and again, this is a Jewish interpretation. You gotta love the rabbis, because they just come up with the craziest questions and things. But it leads, I think, to such great insight. And one of the first questions the rabbis ask about Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, letter 1. Because remember, within Judaism, God does not simply inspire every word, God inspires every letter. And every letter has a purpose. And so, Bereshith is the first word in Genesis 1:1, and it begins with a bet, a B. And so, the rabbis ask, why does the first word of the first chapter of the first book of the Torah begin with a B and not what?
An A.
An Aleph, precisely. So, school of rabbis, why a B?
It's not the first thing.
It's not the first thing, yeah, but no. It has to do with its form. Remember, you read Hebrew from left to right. This way, right? So the bait here is what? Open. And so again, you would start with the bait, you would start with the open letter, because openness always designates future. And so just like you would say, when God began to create, creation is ongoing and continuing, you would begin with the bait, with the B, because this is a letter that is open. And so all of creation, the future, proceeds out of this. And so therefore, again, when one talks about beginnings, what one is really talking about is this recognition of openness, and indeed the sense of how God always creates for us a future. And right, part of our heads have kind of been conditioned now that we think creation is always a past kind of, oh yeah, creation happened back then, or even evolutionarily speaking, right? Big Bang, 13.3 billion years ago, which is a little longer length of time than I can imagine. But, you know, it's always past.
And well, yeah, because when you do this translation, when God created is past tense.
Yeah.
And that's why when you said when God began to create, like you were saying, it's an ongoing process. It's not a past tense process.
Right.
So it says, yeah, it changes it drastically.
Yeah. Although, again, grammatically speaking, you can translate it that way. But it, right? I mean, again, this is, translation is always interpretation. So depending on how you translate it is already indicative of how you understand that text. And so I'm just pointing out here the differences, at least between the standard Jewish interpretation of that first verse and the typical Christian interpretation of this first verse, and just this first clause, and how we have a different understanding here of beginnings. Right. And as well, right, when we move on to verse 2, we have somewhat of a new understanding of beginning. Verse 2, and I'll just read this from the NRSV. It says, "The earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters." Okay. So here, the significance is that while, if you want to say the first verse, Genesis 1:1, says there is creation out of nothing, Genesis 1:2 suggests that it's more a sense of creation out of chaos. And here, reasons for that are that, again, Genesis chapter 1, that creation account is, in terms of sources, a priestly source. So this creation account is put forward while the Jews were in exile in Babylon and afterwards. And so therefore, part of Genesis chapter 1 and their understanding of creation is trying to put down the Babylonian gods, and particularly Marduk, who is the head of all of the Babylonian gods. And in the creation story of the Babylonians, it is Marduk who engages in a cosmic battle with Tiamat, the dragon of the deep. And Tiamat, to whom, is the word there that we have in English that's talked about deep. And of course, Tiamat was the personification of chaos. Marduk defeats her by using a strong cutting wind that, as the Enuma Elish says, cuts her in two like a shellfish. And then Tiamat cut in two, half of Tiamat becomes the earth, and the other half of Tiamat becomes the heavens. Right. And there you have it. Well, here, right, the notion is, no, it's not Marduk or anything that's doing that. This is our God who is doing this. And out of this chaos, note that it is a wind from God who sweeps over the deep, who sweeps over Tiamat, but indeed does not, you know, slice the dragon in half, but simply in it almost seems to suggest just simply with this wind sweeps her out of the way so that creation can take place, right? Kind of the polemic there is saying, okay, all you Babylonians and your gods, what does our God do? Just sweep them out of the way, blow them away like the wind. Now let's talk creation and what happens and what our God is going to do. And so here again, it's the sense that we recognize creation in terms of the way in which God can create things out of chaos. It's a more, if you will, existential interpretation, because think of the situation in which the exiles found themselves, right? There they are in Babylon. Their temple is destroyed. Their sacred times and holidays are no longer kept. All they have yet is a sense of the word and a sense of God. But it's very chaotic. And out of that chaos of their lives, right, the priestly tradition tells us, recognize that God is still in charge. That God will indeed create and provide for you a future. And we see that taken up in the book of the prophet Isaiah, right? Where again, God brings them home from exile. And bringing them home from exile entails, too, creative and redemptive acts. Right? That whole sense of God will prepare the highway for you to come home, and what? The crooked is going to be made straight, and the rough places are going to be made plain, level. And so what is going to happen for you, my beloved children, my beloved people, is that all that crookedness and brokenness in your lives is going to be straightened out, is going to be leveled, because I, again, will give you life, will give you purpose. We see that kind of thing, for example, Isaiah chapter 45, verses 18 to 25. If you turn to that, please. Isaiah 45, 18 to 25. And if someone finds that, if they would just read it for us, please. So we get a sense of what's going on there.
For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, he is God. Who formed the earth and made it, he established it. He did not create it a chaos. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. All the way to 25?
Yes, please.
I did not speak secret in a land of darkness. I did not say to the offspring of Jacob, seek me in chaos. I, the Lord, speak the truth, and I declare what is right. Somebody else want to carry on? Anybody there?
Assemble yourselves and come together. Draw near, you survivors of the nations. They have no knowledge. Those who carry about their wooden idols and keep on praying to a God that cannot save. Declare and present your case. Let them take counsel together. Who told you this long ago? Who declared it of old? Was it not I, the Lord? There is no other God besides me, a righteous God and a Savior. There is no one besides me.
We can stop there. Right? You get the set, right? It starts out, those first few verses assert God, creator. But then note that whole creative activity becomes redemptive activity. Right? I'm the righteous one, a savior, a deliverer. And so that again, creation is redemptive and redemption is creative. The both of those are the same actions and force of God at work, creating for us purpose, possibilities, a future, the way in which we can bring ourselves together. One last thing I'll say here, and then we should move on. And that's as we come to the end of the creation story. This is in chapter 1, verse 31. It says there, God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. Okay, so we have that pronouncement of very good. Again, the rabbis want to comment on that, and they say, quote, "It says that God found his creation to be very good, which implies a comparison. From this, it may be inferred that God had created and destroyed previous worlds." Ooh, there you go. They're very close readers of text, right? They said, you know, God didn't say perfect. He said very good. So, hold it. Beginning together. You can look back and we can say, right. I mean, all these years I've come here. Yes, hold it. Well, it's been very good. Not perfect. So guess what? Keep creating. Right? Keep working. Keep beginning again. Because even God, apparently, is still trying to get it right. Very good. Not perfect. There might be more worlds yet to come. And so, a way to think about that sense of creation and what that implies.
Michael, is there anything in the translation there in good that's different than we would?
No. The Hebrew there is megal tov, just very good.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, it's just simply they're saying, it didn't say perfect, right? It's a comparison. And so therefore, that means could be better. Maybe this isn't the first world or the only world that God created. Think about that. All right, let's try in the beginning in John chapter 1. Again, a very familiar text. And to think about beginnings there, just stay up. I've put up just the first two verses here to say that John is trying to answer almost like a journalist. A when, a where, a who, and then comes up with recognition. So that again, in the beginning was the Word. And that wants to answer the when of the Word. Right? In other words, one can say, when is the origin of the Word? As we understand that to be. And we'll see that as we look at all of the Gospels, that sense of beginning, that when, is different. So that, for example, when is the beginning of the Word in Mark?
Baptism
of Jesus. Right? For Mark, that's when it all starts. What about Matthew? When does it all start?
Nativity?
The Nativity. Little bit before, Joseph has a dream. And then zip off to Bethlehem, and the wise men show up a little later, and that's when it all starts. What about Luke? If you will, there the interesting thing is in kind of the beginning of the Word is before the Word, right? With that annunciation to Zechariah that Elizabeth will have a child, and that child will again be the forerunner for the Messiah. And the interesting thing there about that, the sense of creation there, is what's the key characteristic of Elizabeth?
Old
and
barren.
Right. Can't have children. Nothing. Out of nothing. Right? Again, God creates. God brings about a child, a prophet. Right? This is the creative activity again that there again you can see Genesis 1:1 if you want to. In the beginning, as far as Luke is concerned, it was barren. And God acts, graciously acts, takes over. John isn't happy with any of that. So he goes, oh, no, we have to go back, right? We go back to the very beginning, right? When the Word was with God, right? The where of the Word. This is the question of origin. It's a key question in John's Gospel because remember, so often Jesus does something and people ask the question, where is he from? Right? And of course, to say from Nazareth is not a satisfactory answer, right? And even for us, right, where are we from? To say from our parents, not a satisfactory answer, right? Conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus. Right? Nicodemus comes to him, asks some questions, and Jesus says to him, well, look, you've got to be born from above. And born again. And wise theologian that Nicodemus says, I don't think I can crawl back into my mother's womb, can I? You know, you don't get it, do you? Right? You have to understand again, right, that for us too, our beginnings, our origins are with God. Right? That's the whole, one of the key things that John is trying to communicate throughout his gospel. And so therefore, the Word was God. There we have that sense of who it is that we are talking about. That one was in the beginning with God, and then throughout the rest of the prologue, verses 3 through 18, it's all about the sense of recognition. Knowing who Jesus is and what that's all about. Just one example there. Right, verse 10. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. Right? That sense of recognition that is there. And the issue throughout this whole gospel is that sense of recognition. Another way of putting John chapter 1, verse 1, to help us understand it a bit differently. A friend of mine who's a translator for Wycliffe Bible Translations, they've come out with a translation of the New Testament in Hawaiian Pidgin. It's a Pidgin English with the Hawaiian dialect, native Hawaiian dialect there. And so this is This is how John chapter 1, verse 1 reads in Hawaiian Pidgin. The time everything had start had one guy, God's talk. That's who him. That guy and God, they stay together. And the guy stay God for real kind. There you go. Interesting, right? Had one guy. God's talk. Right? A forceful way, I think, right? Of presenting this kind of understanding and all that that implies. More of this sense of recognition going towards the end of what's here. Verses 17 and 18. And here the interesting thing is the distinction John wants to make between gift and grace and how we understand the beginnings, because both the law was a beginning, but grace far surpasses that. For while the law was a gift through Moses, grace and truth, Raymond Brown in his commentary says grace and truth should really be read as one word or as one concept, and he translates it as enduring love. But grace and truth or enduring love became Jesus Messiah. In other words, just as the Word became flesh, what we see here in this beginning is grace and truth became Jesus. No one has ever seen God. God, the only Son, that parallels the was God of verse 1, whose being is into the heart of the Father, parallels with God. That one led us, and then it just stops. And you have to supply the heart of God. It parallels was the Word. In other words, John wants to make, or kind of complete the circle here, in terms of what he said in 1:1, he is again saying, only in a different way, in chapter 18, or in verse 18, about how we understand the beginning of what God is about in Jesus. And that indeed it happens for the very beginning of creation, but that sense, and here again there's this continuing sense of creation. The key here is again grace and truth became Jesus. So that in other words, that sense of incarnation, right, is truly a sense of the incarnating of God. And a similar kind of passage would be the Christ hymn in Philippians chapter 2. Humbled himself, became obedient even to death on a cross. Right. The sense here is the gracious act of God, if you will, is that God is downwardly mobile. Right. The downward mobility of God is that gracious, faithful act of God for us. And the beginning for us of seeing that gracious God happens in Jesus, with Jesus, in terms of, if you will, we see grace embodied, grace enfleshed, which is different than a gift, because a gift still implies some sense of obligation. Gift is always targeted toward a specific individual or group. And here, the sense of grace is that it doesn't know those kinds of boundaries. That it's broader than that, and it is given unconditionally. There are no conditions there whatsoever to tie us into any other way of thinking about who God is. Rudolf Bultmann, in his commentary on John's Gospel, says about this verse, verse 17, became Jesus. He says, the encounter with Christ becomes a challenge rather than a persuasive appeal. The challenge is to dare to see God as human, to accept that God is revealed in the flesh of this particular human being, Jesus.
Right. That is the challenge.
And of course, that's the challenge. Right. That's again sets up the kind of metaphors that John uses in terms of people are blind. Right. Why are they blind? Well, because they cannot see, they cannot recognize God in this human Jesus. Right. That becomes the challenge that is there, the challenge that confronts each of us. So, given that, the wedding at Cana, what does that have to do with creation? It's Jesus' first, what John calls, sign or miracle. It's in John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. And John starts out, of course, a kind of a week in the life of Jesus. And note, as chapter 2 starts out, on the third day. Kind of know. We're smart. We know what third days mean, right? There was a wedding in Cana, and the mother of Jesus was there, Jesus and all of his disciples, and so on. Verse 3. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Okay. What situation is this poor wedding party in?
No hospitality.
Disaster.
Disaster. Or, to cheat a little bit,
chaos.
They have no wine. We can put this other one up here too. Nothing. Right. So here we are. Wedding celebration. Time of great joy and what? A situation of nothing. Of chaos. Because if the guests find out there's no more wine, guess who's going to get surly? Right. Just like when there's no more coffee. And that, or even worse, when there's no ice cream on a hot day in July and it's been hunger awareness lunch. Surly people. Right? Verse 5, again, Jesus' mother. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Right? There again, the sent, do whatever he tells, right? Listen to his word. Or he is the word. And as we will see here again, just like in John 1, it is the word who will give life. Verses 9 and 10. Right. The steward tasted the water that had become wine, and did not know where it came from. Though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. You've kept the good wine until now." Right. Note here, first of all, right, that again, act of creation from nothing or chaos, if you will, water became wine. And then the poor steward didn't know where it came from. Right. What's the origin of this? What is its source? Do we understand the grace, the superabundant grace that's behind all of this, such that you have saved the best wine for last? And note here again that here the steward says, right, every serves the good wine first, then the inferior. The implication here is best, if you will, more than very good. This one is perfect. Superior wine, superior grace that comes from the Word. One other question here. Have you ever asked yourself in this story, why six jars?
No.
No, never asked yourself that.
Is that how many they were required to have by
no.
law?
No.
6 days of creation.
That's what I would venture. 6 days of creation. Remember, these were water jars, as it says, set about for purification. And purification, right, was for the, right, you're going to be purified because, to use our anglicized word here, you're going to be kosher, right? Kosher, Hebrew word kadosh, which means holy, literally means to set apart or to separate. And what God does in Genesis chapter 1, if you look at that sense of creation, most of it is that sense of separation. Right? Water goes here, dry land goes here, sun up here, moon over here, day, night, and then we create, right? We've got the water and we've got the land, firmament in the air. And so in the water, right, the literal word for that, in the water you got the swimmers, on the land you got the creepers, and in the air you got the flyers. Because after all, fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, right? So I mean, it's all nice and separated. And so these jars, the six jars of purification, the 6 days of separation, that whole way of thinking now, creation begins a new way, where indeed with the Word, that now creation is again transformed into what it should be, a sense of pure grace and pure joy. And again, at least in Greek, there's a little word play there. This is my last charis with an A is the Greek word for joy. Charis with an I is the Greek word for grace. Now those are homonyms, right? Because if I say charis, what am I saying? Joy or grace? You can only tell that in context. But you see, right, at this wedding feast of Canaan, what was the end result of that creative act of the Word? Charis. grace, joy. That is what Jesus, the Word, the creative Word of God, enables to begin for all of us, that our lives too can be lives of celebration. Celebration to the Creator, because what has been created for us is grace and joy. And that is what we always live in. And that becomes that sense of the creative work of God for us. We'll stop there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tough on a late afternoon.